You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, April 15th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, to discuss the ongoing travesty of Guantanamo Bay, John Neffel, independent journalist and co-host of
Radio Dispatch.
Also on the program today, it's tax day, folks. Where are your taxes going? Who's paying those taxes? Well, surprise, surprise. Still the rich are making off like bandits in this era of shared sacrifice. Also, more on the attempts from some of these dead enders, I guess, white knucklers, to justify President Obama's now, I think, pretty clear, disastrous offer of cuts to Social Security. Meanwhile, a story from last week that I never got to, but because of my health issues. You remember that whole thing about how we need that drone program to kill people who would do us harm in an imminent fashion, and imminent was sort of vague, and harm was sort of vague, and all those things. Well, it appears, according to a McClatchy report, that we're not even abiding by that standard, that amorphous standard. And finally, you'll be happy to know, George Bush feels comfortable with himself. He's not upset. He thinks, you know, I did all right. I'm comfortable with myself. Mission accomplished. I said it once. I don't want to have to say it again. Dozens of people died today in Iraq. Mission accomplished. I did it. I feel comfortable with that.
I'm comfortable with that.
I'm not freaking out about it. Maybe I'll draw a painting. Maybe I'll paint a painting. How's that? Smart guy trying to correct me. Over the weekend, this is a story that is so twisted with irony, it's hard to contemplate. The NRA sponsored a NASCAR Sprint Cup race for the first time this weekend, wherein a fan, Kirk Franklin, 42-year-old man from Saginaw, Texas, who was camping in the infield, committed suicide by shooting himself in the head. It was it stemmed from an argument occurred near a pickup truck in the infield and may have been alcohol related. The NRA had announced that it would sponsor the race earlier this year in response to its desire to enhance its image, I guess, following the wake of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shootings. It had previously sponsored the nationwide series race in Atlanta last fall. And apparently, the NASCAR spokesperson has said that the NRA sponsorship at the event at the Texas Motor Speedway fit within existing parameters. However, this situation made it clear we need to take a closer look at our approval process moving forward.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Now, in that scenario, who's the good guy and who's the bad guy with the gun? I can't quite figure that one out.
Well, because the guy had the ability to shoot himself in the head, he prevented somebody else, I guess, from shooting himself in the head. I have no idea. But the NRA, keep up the good work, guys. I wonder if they will put that into an ad. You know, the effectiveness of their guns down the road. I don't know. Weird story. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to John Neffel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Independent journalist and co-host of Radio Dispatch, John Neffel. John, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So, John, all right. Now, I know we spoke to you after a trip you made down to Guantanamo in, we spoke to you, I believe it was in October. And I know you've been back down there since, and you're planning to go, I think, within a couple of weeks. First off, tell us what's been going on with this this hunger strike. There was just a devastating op-ed in the New York Times. I guess it came out today or yesterday, talking about this hunger strike. But just give us let us know what you know.
Well, there are sort of two elements to Guantanamo Bay. There is the one side, the sort of hunger-striking side, and then there's the other side, which is the military commission side, which is the sort of alternate legal universe that I have been down there covering. The main reason that Guantanamo Bay has been in the news, obviously, is this increasingly dire hunger strike. It is now in its third month. I believe we're on somewhere around day 70, I believe, and the official count from the Pentagon is 43 hunger strikers. The defense attorneys say that the number is much higher, that it could be as high as 130 detainees. And this op-ed details in excruciating minutiae how painful the force feeding is. So there are now, I believe, 13 detainees who are being regularly force fed. And what the author writes through his lawyers in the New York Times is that the process is that the tube gets snaked up your nose and down into your chest, and that he says that it's the most excruciating pain he's ever felt, that he regularly collapses from fatigue. And this mirrors in a lot of ways the characterizations that we've heard from Shaker Amer, who's a British citizen who is also being force-fed, and who says that he regularly collapses. The British government has called for Amer to be to be released back to Britain, and he has been cleared for release, but he continues to be held.
Yeah, I mean, can you explain this? I mean, there's 166 prisoners in Guantanamo. Is that right? Is it 166?
Yes.
Okay, and we know that there's essentially three statuses, I guess, or correct me if I'm wrong. One is those awaiting so-called trial through these military commissions. One is a group that the Obama administration has deemed untriable, I guess, because there's either no evidence or evidence that they can find that is admissible, but they think that they're a danger and so they can't be released. So we're just going to, I guess, hold them until they die. And then there's another group that essentially the Bush administration and the Obama administration have said they're no threat to anybody. And we're just going to hold them until people forget about it. Right. I mean, that's the thing I don't understand. The British government is saying, release this guy. The Obama administration is saying he poses no threat to U.S. citizens. We have no nothing to charge him with. Why is he still there?
Well, I think that that's a really important question. And those three statuses that you described are absolutely right. And the really key number here, I think, of Guantanamo Bay is 86. And that's the number of prisoners there who have been cleared from a review board that includes all of the relevant government agencies. They are they will never be charged. They have been determined not to be threats if they are released, and yet they continue to be held, despite even the government of Yemen now is calling for at least some detainees to be transferred back there. And that's significant because after the failed underwear bomber plot in late 2009, the Obama administration issued a moratorium on transferring detainees to Yemen. And that is not something that Obama can blame Congress for or anything else. That is an active step that his administration took, and one that we should note that Peter King, the representative who held hearings in Congress on the radicalization of Muslims, that liberals were very, very quick to deride and call Islamophobic. Peter King praised Obama for issuing this moratorium on sending people to Yemen. So that's really one of the major stumbling blocks right now is in getting people released, is this self-imposed moratorium. And then beyond that, groups like the Center for Constitutional Rights and Human Rights Watch have also said that there is a way for President Obama or for Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel to issue these national security waivers and for Chuck Hagel to personally certify detainees transfer. And that, they argue, is a way around the congressional ban on using funds to move anyone. And so for the Obama administration to stay completely silent, as they have, and for sort of Democrats generally to blame the continued existence of Guantanamo Bay solely on Republican opposition is, I think, is in very, very bad faith and is demonstrably untrue.
Well, right. And it was, I mean, it was also Democrats who voted. There were Democrats in the House that voted to supposedly deny the president funds to move these prisoners. But it also sort of stretches the imagination that President Obama couldn't say to Great Britain, hey, I'll tell you what, we'll release this guy that you want. Can you spring for the $20,000 it's going to cost, or the $100,000, or the $200,000? I mean, I don't know what the figure is, but the complete virtually insignificant amount of money so that I can say to Congress, we're not using U.S. funds to do this. I mean, it's sort of an absurd excuse at this point.
Well, right.
And you're suggesting that there's other mechanisms. I mean, the president can authorize unilateral strikes on people. The president can bring people to war, but he cannot authorize a couple hundred thousand dollars to fly some people out on a plane. That seems to be a bit of a stretch.
Well, exactly. And as far as money goes, the Pentagon is asking for $200 million in new funds to renovate and to update the prisons at Guantanamo Bay, including $50 million of that for an update of Camp 7, which is where the high-value detainees are held, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-proclaimed 9/11 mastermind. And so what we have here is Obama's administration has closed down the office in the State Department whose job it was to figure out how to close Guantanamo Bay. And it looks increasingly like the Pentagon is going to have these new funds, at least partially, to house elderly detainees, which, you know, some commenters have suggested that the plan, as it sort of appears to be the case, is to hold the detainees for the rest of their natural life. And it should also be noted that the International Committee of the Red Cross and Physicians for Human Rights have both come out against force feeding. They say that if a person is mentally able to determine whether or not they want to eat, they have the right to make that choice. But of course, the U.S. government has come out and said that they will not allow any prisoners to starve themselves to death. And one of the main things that caused the raid on Saturday morning, where detainees were moved from the communal living situation into individual maximum security style cells, is that they had been using cardboard and things like that to cover the surveillance cameras. So the military says it was afraid that they were doing that so that they could essentially die without the military knowing how weak they had become. And so that just gives you a sense of how completely desperate this situation is. And in that raid, the military fired, or the security forces fired four quote-unquote less than lethal rounds at the detainees who they say were using improvised weapons, like a broom handle, against them. And so this also comes amid a media blackout. There are no reporters there. There have been no reporters allowed to go for weeks, according to Charlie Savage in the New York Times.
Okay, so, and just you know, to make this clear to people, there was literally a raid on these half-starving prisoners so that they could not die. Essentially, because they were preventing the U.S. their guards from knowing that they were on the brink of death. Basically avoiding some type of force feeding process. So they have now put them into individual cells. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
I mean, it's just bizarre. The whole thing is just sort of beyond bizarre at this point.
It's true. When you kind of take a step back and try to put the whole picture in your head at once, it's so horrifying that it almost doesn't seem real. It doesn't seem like it could be actually happening right now. And it is. And the media, really up until I think the hunger strike, the media was completely ignoring Guantanamo Bay. And Pentagon spokespeople have said that this hunger strike is a ploy for media attention or something sort of dismissive like that. And what it's done has, it's brought the issue to a certain extent back in the spotlight, and it's really revealed the otherwise hidden horrors of what's happening there.
I mean, it seems quite obvious that at least part of it is a, I mean, I wouldn't know if I would call it a ploy, but yes, it's to get media attention so that people realize that we are holding individuals without charging them for 10 and 11 years, that we are basically just set up a place where we're bringing these, you know, more or less these disappeared people and, you know, setting up an old age home for them so they can die down there in prison without ever having had an opportunity to clear themselves, without ever being convicted of anything, without and in at least, like you say, 86 of these cases being completely innocent of anything that the government ever had thought that they had done at that point and having it being acknowledged by them. It is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, this is like a piece of fiction. I mean, it's crazy.
It is. And it's important to remember that, some of the people who are there were sold to the United States. Because there was just a general bounty out for accused Al Qaeda members and accused Taliban members at the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, and so some of the people were just picked up and sold off for a bounty, and to put yourself in the shoes of someone like that, it's hard to imagine a more nightmarish situation being abducted and then held like that.
Let me just clarify for people what you're talking about, that in the wake of 9/11 and our invasion of Afghanistan, there was a bounty basically put out. You had villagers basically come in. If they're having some dispute with their neighbor about property, or they have had a long time feud with this guy because he's a jerk, they went in and told U.S. officials, that guy is associated with Al-Qaeda, and pay me my money. They took this guy away, whose one issue may have just been not getting along with the first guy who went in to claim that he's Al-Qaeda. And then 11 years later, the guy is being force-fed through a tube because he hasn't been able to see his family for 11 years. I mean, this is just... It's just stunning. And now, let me ask you this. From a political standpoint, okay, there's obviously some political implications. And I'm talking about sort of just the most mundane political implications of having Chuck Hagel issue some type of national security directive that, in you know, we can use any means necessary under the authorization of military force, keeping prisoners in Guantanamo who have clearly done nothing in some way implicates the war on terror or whatever you want to call it. And so we have issued funds to get rid of these people, to send them to Yemen, to send them back to Great Britain, to send them to China, wherever it is. What do you think the political calculation here is from the Obama history? I mean, how much of a price do they think they're going to pay at this point? So much so that they've even gotten rid of the apparatus to figure out how to mechanically do this in terms of getting these prisoners, repatriating these prisoners.
Well, I think, unfortunately, the calculus that the Obama administration has made is that it is, that they face less risk by keeping the prison open and by not even attempting to create the illusion of closing it. And I think that there are very few, if any, constituencies in the United States that have less political power than accused terrorists, and especially accused terrorists being held in Guantanamo Bay. And I think that the administration, it seems to me that they think that this either will pass, or that they can pass off the political blame to GOP obstructionism. And the fact that they think they can do that, whether or not it's right, I think really goes to show how you know, how radical how radical U.S. politics have become, and how fully the Obama administration has embraced and really expanded the Bush era thinking on the so-called war on terror.
Well, what's also stunning about their closing down that part, that office in the State Department that was tasked with sort of figuring out the operational details of repatriating these, is that they don't even feel it's important enough to pretend that President Obama is going to do this in his lame duck session. Right. I mean, you know, if he doesn't want to deal with the politics of this, fine. He'll just authorize this on 2013 in December of 2013. He'll authorize it. He'll take it off the table. There won't be a problem for his, he'll show some sympathy for that president who follows him and somehow deal with this situation. They don't even need to pretend that's what they're going to do. I don't know. It's just stunning to me. Let's turn just for a moment to the commissions, because that's what you've been following. There was a report this past week that defense attorneys were claiming, and apparently the Pentagon acknowledged, but they said it was just a mistake, that their defense documents and emails were being accessed, let's say, by somebody. Tell us what you know on that front.
So late in the day on Wednesday of last week, Air Force Colonel Mayberry, who is the chief defense counsel, essentially one of the top Guantanamo Bay defense attorneys, issued an order to all of the attorneys and staff who work on the defense in these cases, that they were barred from using the DOD email system for privileged information, because this incredibly large cache of emails had been in the Pentagon's telling of it inadvertently turned over to the prosecution side after the prosecution had requested documents about an appeal for another case, and whether it was just sort of bureaucratic bumbling or something more nefarious, it's total speculation. But at the end of the day, the prosecution had at least some access to some defense emails. Now, what the Pentagon says is that they only had access to the to line and the from line. But this is a kind of situation where the spokespeople are trying to mitigate what happened because it sounds so bad. But even if you take them at their word, you still have a situation where the defense can't ensure the protection of their privileged information between the attorneys and their clients, and attorneys are bound by their professional ethics to maintain that privilege and that relationship. So it would be improper and could result in professional sanctions or worse, if they continued to use emails when they couldn't ensure that wouldn't eventually be turned over to the prosecution, or could even the fact that it could be turned over in any capacity seems to mean that the defense thinks that they can't that their email and their communication isn't secure. And in a somewhat related manner, it's not entirely clear how much work, but a huge amount of work. Some people are saying 7 gigabytes. One person I talked to said 3 or 4 weeks worth of work had disappeared from Pentagon servers. And again, it seems like that could have been an IT glitch or something. But the end result is that there was a huge amount of work, motions, briefs, and responses, et cetera, that was lost because of this probable error. And again, this is a situation where these military commissions are going so slowly. They move at a snail's pace, and there was actually supposed to be one happening this week for a guy named al-Nashiri, who is the one of the accused plotters in the USS Cole bombing in Yemen in 2000. His defense attorney filed an emergency motion to pause the commission because he wasn't able to use the DOD computer system, essentially. And the judge, Judge James Pohl, who is a military judge, granted that that abatement, as they call it. And the attorneys for the 9/11 trial that's supposed to be happening next week, which I'm scheduled to go down, filed their own emergency motion that was handwritten to sort of dramatize the fact that they couldn't use their computers. The judge has yet to rule on that, so it's unclear if there is going to be a commission next week or not. But even when the commissions do happen, they move incredibly slowly, certainly much more slowly than a lot of observers expect they would move if they were happening in a normal civilian Article III court.
So, John, if we were to stipulate and grant the Pentagon's version of events, there has been a massive failure to secure privileged correspondence between defense attorneys and amongst defense attorneys and clients. There's been a massive failure to protect privileged materials that have been developed by the defense for the defense. Just a mistake. But it has now provided a chilling effect on the defense attorney's ability to work and to function. So in the best case scenario, the Pentagon can't even protect some of the most sensitive material that they're supposed to protect, despite the billions of dollars that they supposedly receive, I guess, for technology. This is to grant them this. All right. I'm trying to give them the best interpretation, and they have completely made what is a really sort of a joke of these commissions even more of a joke. I mean, is that a fair assessment?
I think that you're definitely right to say that even under the best case scenario, what the Pentagon says, that they come out of this looking very, very bad. And again, this
and then
this
the part of me
out of
the part of me that wasn't the, born yesterday says there's a pretty good chance that they saw a little more than they're leading on.
It's certainly possible. And as this issue faces closer scrutiny, we may learn more about it. But this also comes after the intrusion of what everyone basically agrees is the CIA into one of the commissions that happened at the end of January, when there's a kill switch essentially for the media feed, which is on a 40-second delay. So what happens in the courtroom gets pumped to the media 40 seconds afterwards, sort of like if somebody were to swear on live television, it's on a 7-second delay. This is a 40-second delay, they say, the government says, to protect national security. And in late January, the kill switch was hit by somebody other than the judge, and that surprised the defense attorneys and seemed to surprise the judge. And it turned out over the course of the week, no one will say this officially, but everyone will say it unofficially, that the CIA killed the switch. And the judge was furious, and he said that any other outside agencies who have the ability to turn the media feed off. That needs to be dismantled. And so you had the judge, you know, take action to fix this one immediate problem. But there was a kind of problem that I don't think anyone had even considered. So you get into this kind of Rumsfeldian, you don't even know what you don't know,
right,
situation with the military commissions. And now with this latest inability to protect privileged information, there are perhaps unsurprisingly rampant fears of surveillance among defense attorneys. And this just goes even more, it heightens those fears, I think, considerably.
Well, I mean, I appreciate the report, John. It's just so disturbing. And, you know, I don't know what's more disturbing about this, the total silence in Congress, the total silence from the Obama administration, or the fact that it seems that the vast, vast, vast majority of Americans don't care. It's just out of sight, out of mind. And this is not, you know, this is not even to mention sort of the implications of the entire system that has been set up to deal with these people, aside from the fact that even the system itself is just a joke, because they'd keep all of the people in there forever if they didn't have the meager amount of ability they have to prosecute some of them under what is sort of a, you know, increasingly clear, like a, if not a kangaroo court, whatever is somewhere between a legitimate court and kangaroo court in terms of these proceedings, because it really is a shame. But, John, I appreciate your coverage of this, and you're coming on to talk to us about it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
All right. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but I want to read this part of this op-ed from the New York Times, from Samir Naji al-Hassan Mokbel, who is this Yemeni national who is one of the people who we're hearing from secondhand on this hunger strike through their attorneys. The other one that we've heard from, and I believe it's just these two in particular, although we've heard maybe not necessarily direct direct via the attorney's words, but we've heard reports of the hunger strike from several prisoners. But the other one, of course, is Shaker Amer, that the British, the UK resident who the British have said, release him to us. He's not being held for any reason. He's cleared to go. Release him. So Mokbel writes, I've been on a hunger strike since February 10th. Lost well over 30 pounds. I will not eat until they restore my dignity. I've been detained at Guantanamo for 11 years and 3 months. I've never been charged with any crime. I have never received a trial. I could have been at home years ago. No one seriously thinks I'm a threat, but I'm still here. Years ago, the military said I was a guard for Osama bin Laden, but this was nonsense. They don't even seem to believe it anymore, but they don't seem to care how long I sit here either. When I was at home in Yemen in 2000, a childhood friend of mine told me that in Afghanistan I could do better than the $50 a month I earned at a factory and support my family. I never really traveled. I knew nothing about Afghanistan, but I gave it a try. I was wrong to trust him. There was no work. I wanted to leave, but had no money to fly home. After the American invasion of 2001, I fled to Pakistan like everyone else. The Pakistanis arrested me when I asked to see someone from the Yemeni embassy. I was then sent to Kandahar and put on the first plane to Gitmo. Last month, on March 15th, I was sick in prison hospital. I refused to be fed. A team from the Extreme Reaction Force, a squad of 8 military police officers in riot gear, burst in. They tied my hands and feet to the bed. They forcibly inserted an IV into my hand. I spent 26 hours in this state, tied to the bed. During this time, I was not permitted to go to the toilet. They inserted a catheter, which was painful, degrading, and unnecessary. I was not even permitted to pray. I will never forget the first time they passed the feeding tube up my nose. Can't describe how painful it is to be force-fed this way. I am still being force-fed. I'm obviously skipping around here a little bit. There are so many of us on hunger strike now, there aren't enough qualified medical staff members to carry out the force feedings, so nothing happens at regular intervals. During one force feeding, the nurse pushed the tube about 18 inches into my stomach, hurting me more than usual because she was doing things so hastily. I called the interpreter to ask the doctor if the procedure was being done correctly or not. It was so painful, I begged them to stop feeding me. The nurse refused to stop feeding me. When they come to force me into the chair, if I refuse to be tied up, they call in the ERF team. So I have a choice. I can either exercise my right to protest my detention and be beaten up, or I can submit to painful force feeding. The only reason I am still here is that President Obama refuses to send any detainees back to Yemen. This makes no sense. I'm a human being, not a passport, and I deserve to be treated like one. Where is my government? I will submit to any security measures, in quotes, they want in order to go home, even though they are totally unnecessary. I'll agree to whatever it takes in order to be free. I'm now 35. All I want to do is see my family again and start a family of my own. At least 40 people here are on strike, on a hunger strike. People are fainting with exhaustion every day. I have vomited blood. I hope that because of the pain we are suffering, the eyes of the world will once again to look to Guantanamo before it's too late. I mean, this is just, I guess, you know, there's one of two possible responses that Americans can have. They can express their outrage to other Americans and their elected officials, or they can just, you know, check out and see who's on Dancing with Stars this week and forget about it. And I would suggest that the response seems to be mostly the latter. Maybe they watch a different show. Maybe it's not Dancing with Stars. Maybe it's, I don't know. What's big these days? Pimp My Ride? Is that still going?
Oh, my God. That show hasn't been on the air for years.
Well, I'm sure you can see repeats somewhere. That's basically it. All right, we're going to take a break. Head into the better half of the program. Folks, it's your memberships that make for 99% of the revenue for this program. Without them, we can't do it. With them and with more of them, we can do what we do better. So I hope you will, if you can afford to support this program, I hope you will. Coming up in the next half of the program, we will talk about the one aspect of the budget that may drive Howard Dean out of the Democratic Party. And we will talk about the incredibly lame, I don't know, analysis that these dead-end, white-knuckled Obama bot supporters are using to justify the cuts to Social Security in the president's budget proposal. I really hope we start to see more Democrats create some distance between themselves and President Obama. And I know that he's gone out there fundraising this time around for Congress, and he's probably using this money as a means of holding some type of support together for himself. But that's why it's so crucial when you see an elected representative who is fighting back against these proposals that you think is ridiculous, that you support them in some fashion or another. And we'll talk about the heartwarming story of a Georgia governor who is saying that this notion that he would support this so-called integrated prom is ridiculous because, of course, there's some type of leftist conspiracy going on to get publicity for, I guess, integrated proms. And God forbid you would ever do that. So we will talk about that and more in the better half So, folks, join us there. You can also support this program by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link. You can find that at majority.fm/support the show. You can also pick up your coffee at justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, organic if you want it. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Folks, we're still looking for someone to help us with a video intro for our YouTubes. So if you are someone who is able to help out with that, you're good with motion graphics, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Sometimes it takes us a bit to respond, but bear with us. And if you have any comments or questions, of course, we always welcome those at majorityreporters@gmail.com. And check out Radio Dispatch, the show that the Neffels do.
And if you're an Obama bot, you should call into this show.
Oh, definitely.
At 646-257-3920.
Just briefly, I get spammed by these Obama bots who call me an emo prog for being upset about the chain CPI, I guess. I guess it's fortunate that I wasn't, that I was too ill at the time that President Obama made his comment to the Attorney General of California. Because the funny thing is, I've seen people who are generally very supportive of President Obama criticize him and then get spammed as an emo prog, I guess, or a femo prog, maybe. I don't know. A femo prog? I don't know what they call it. But if you're, if you're one of these non-emo progs, and you can make a case, and I've begged people to make a case. Now, I've heard Jonathan Alter's case. We had him on the program before the budget came out, and that was that, you know, basically some argument about Social Security being unstable, and we just need to cut benefits, and we disagreed. What I've noticed is people are pretending like, well, there are no cuts. It's not a cut. Or if it is a cut, it's a 14,000 dimensional chess move. And I'll read some piece from one of these sites, but I would love, if you're one of these people, please call in and just, I'll give you as much time as you need within reason to make this case. Cause I would like to hear somebody who actually cares about Social Security, make the case. But they tend not to do it. They just like to spam you on Twitter and call you an emo prog.
Libertarians call this show, and they talk about light bulbs, and they talk about Ford, and they have the courage of their convictions, I guess what I'm trying to say, no matter how crazy those convictions are.
Yes.
So have a call. Call in. Have some
guts. All right.
Your best tweet came from this. In my opinion, your best tweet happened over the weekend when you were responding to one of these guys who called you an emo prog. There's this guy who constantly attacks Sam online on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that big of a deal. But the worst part about it is just spam.
But you tweeted at him, "I know you are a parody, but I have no idea who you are parodying. Someone specific or just the cowardly in general?"
Yes. For a while, it did look like he was just a parody site. All right, folks. See you on the flip side. Satan, I will pay.